Welcome to The Readout, your guide to Australian development in the region. This is a fortnightly podcast by the Development Intelligence Lab, hosted by our CEO, Bridie Rice.
Well, welcome back, Joe and Jane, for another action-packed episode of The Readout. Today we have three things to discuss. The first up is going to be Australia and the region. We, of course, have had the Shangri-La Dialogue, the Korea Pacific Island Summit, as well as an Indian Prime Ministerial visit. Next, we're going to turn to a tricky article and a little bit of an existential crisis for development. We're going to look at the long, slow death of global development. Of course, this was an article that you recommended to us, James. And then we're going to turn in our final segment to have a look again at the Australian Development Policy. It is still due for release imminently. We think it's going to be out before the end of the month. But we're going to have a look at whether or not we think that government is looking to reset the trajectory of development in Australia. So, first up, Australia in the region. Well, it's all happening. Of course, Albanese was invited to Singapore by the Institute for Strategic Studies to deliver the keynote address at the Shangri-La Dialogue. Now, of course, Shangri-La is Asia's premier defence summit, a unique meeting where ministers debate the region's most pressing security challenges, as well as engage in other important bilateral talks. Now, Albanese's speech has been described by many over the last week or two as a major foreign policy speech. And I just want to have a look at something he said in that. Now, he said, Australia is engaged as a constructive and committed contributor to the solutions to the challenges that all of us will face in the years ahead. Nothing too surprising there. But he then went on to say that investing in our capability and investing in our relationships is key, and that Australia is working to shape the future, not waiting for the future to shape us. Now, what are your reactions to what Albo's saying here?
My first reaction is it's not a development speech. He very deliberately didn't take the opportunity to put development in there. He talked about defence. He talked about diplomacy. So I think a lot of the language we're seeing is ostensibly applicable to development, but I don't think it was a development speech. It was about asserting a strategic context and a strategic perspective.
So you don't think that this idea that Australia would be working to shape the future, not waiting for the future to shape us, is what's playing out in our development policy, James?
Not yet, I don't. I do think there are shifts in the way that the development policy is framing development. But other than to see the similarity of language, I don't think that was the Prime Minister's intention. I think this was very much a strategic speech.
So then why is that? We're seeing our government take a very, very proactive stance in many other forms of Australian foreign policy. What are you making of this, Joe?
I think James is right, it wasn't explicitly about development, but I think the tone was really interesting, and the tone is very similar to what we're seeing in the way that this government does talk about development. It is focused on partnerships and relationships, and it is focused on Australia's own capability, which I think in the development space is also welcomed and necessary, as we've discussed previously. I think in terms of the way that he portrayed Australia's place in the world and the tone and language he used, it was really interesting in terms of what that will mean for Australia as a development actor. I liked the tone. I think that it was much better than tones in the past of deputy sheriff or big brother or punching above our weight kind of language. I think it was a language about Australia being part of the region, being part of a collective that needs to pull together to address big challenges that we're all facing, and Australia wanting to make a positive, proactive contribution in that space. I think you can say the same thing about development, and if you take that tone and approach and apply it to Australia's development policy, I think we'll end up probably seeing the shape and tone of what's to come in the new development policy.
Of course, at the end of May, we also saw Korea host the first Korea Pacific Islands Summit. The theme was navigating towards co-prosperity, strengthening cooperation with the Blue Pacific. And of course, there were 17 leaders and senior officials of the Pacific Island Forum in attendance. And at that summit, South Korea pledged to double its official development assistance program for the Pacific to around about $40 million by 2027. We also saw India's Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, visiting Port Moresby en route to Australia, and this was the first visit by an Indian head of government. He met with 14 visiting leaders of the Pacific Island Forum countries and territories as well. Over the last year or so, we've had a lot of discussions about the US cooperation on development in the Pacific. We always talk about China as well. What do you make of these high-profile visits from Korea and India into the Pacific Islands?
It's the place to be, isn't it? It's the place to come and meet with a group of countries as a collective and have special agreements and special meetings. I think it's really positive for the Pacific in the sense that, of course, it's part of a big complex region. There's lots of different relationships to be had. And so having those dialogues and forming those relationships is really important, really positive. Of course, this is all within a geostrategic context and everyone's got certain interests that are at play in this. I think Korea and India emerging as donor partners in the region is a really interesting development. Korea, I think, doubling its aid to the Pacific is still very small as a proportion of its own aid program. It's like India, I think, mainly focused in Asia, Africa. But I think it's a show of the increasing significance of the Pacific in the region. I think it gives the Pacific more options, greater diversity, not so much a single reliance on traditional donors. I think it'll be interesting to see where it goes, how it develops. I guess both Korea and India have been aid recipients themselves, have been through very interesting development trajectories, and so they bring a really different and interesting perspective to the table compared to Australia, New Zealand, US and the UK. Will that result in innovative and different forms of development partnerships? I think that's what we want to, you know, watch out of that.
James, it's interesting for Australian development in the Pacific. Australia is the largest donor, and in a perfect world, there'd be well-organised, well-coordinated partnerships with other donors like Korea, like India, like the US and others. But that is not always the case. Where do you think Australia should have its eye on cooperation here?
In some ways, I don't think it's a question for Australia. I think it's a question for the Pacific. We've seen a huge growth in the number of development agencies operating across the world. There's now over 500 of them. And this sort of range and number of partners is challenging for any government, and it is particularly challenging for small and less capable governments, or at least less well-resourced governments. I think it's a real issue for the Pacific. Joe's absolutely right. Bringing in different perspectives from India and Korea, for example, is useful. But the flip side is that it's yet more aid bureaucrats knocking on the door of the finance ministry. It's yet more parallel structures. It's yet more diversification away from some of the core issues. We know in the area of health, for example, we know how strong and effective as many of the single funds have been, how they've distorted health systems in recipient countries. I think it's a real issue that needs to be watched, that on the one hand, we can welcome the increased focus, but we do have to be careful about what this could do to the ability of the Pacific governments to lead their own development.
At one point, I was working up in Port Moresby with a fantastic team of young lawyers in the Papua New Guinean government, and they actually counted the number of invitations to workshops and consultations they got over the course of a two-week period. And the number was 32. That was now back 6 or 7 years ago. So I can't imagine what kinds of numbers of engagements and workshops and training people are being invited to right now.
It'll be more. One of the things that suffers when you've got lots of different donors in there with their own monitoring and evaluation systems is the ability of the governments themselves, the Pacific governments themselves, to use their own monitoring frameworks. So not only do the lawyers end up with 32 different invitations, but you end up with a department with, you know, 14 different performance frameworks. And of course, you can't work within that. So I think another area where we need to be realistic and sensible is around how we monitor progress. And as donors, we need to be more careful about creating duplicative systems.
Well, it's certainly something to watch going forward as the new policy does come out. I understand that there is some aspiration and some increased ambition from Australia around donor coordination. And I think that is, you know, on the one hand, like we've discussed, critical for Australia to be aligned with other actors in the region. But most importantly, it's critical that we are not overburdening, under-resourcing the kinds of activities that are meant to generate development, not undermine it. So something to watch there. James, after we finished recording the last episode, you drew our attention to an article. Now, the title was pretty apocalyptic. It's called The Long, Slow Death of Development. It was published back in 2022 by David Ox and Henry Williams. Before we dissect it, James, why did you want to put this on our radar?
Well, a couple of reasons. We talked in our first episode about strengthening capacity, and we talked sort of lightheartedly about care bears. One of the things that I'm reminded of from my education in the field of development back when I was at uni was how excited we used to get over these contests, these intellectual contests between great luminaries in the system about how development was progressing and some of the big challenges of development. And I felt this paper was an interesting attempt to pull together what's been happening over the last few decades and to try and see through some of the noise, to identify a trajectory and to come to some conclusions. I don't necessarily agree with all it had to say, but I think it's an important reminder that the process of development is complex. It is a professional discipline. Many people invest their careers in trying to implement development practice as effectively as possible. And now in particular, the era of polycrisis, it's incredibly difficult to achieve results and to find our way through all these complexities. And I thought that this paper was a good example of how that happened. I think the second point, which is sort of more nuts and bolts, is really what it says about different parts of the world, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, and the trajectories that may be available to them.
What I quite liked about it, James, is I felt as though it explained a little bit of what I feel from development professionals who probably have an extra couple of decades of experience on me. And that was, it really described that great optimism of the 2000s and the 2010s, when it seemed as though the bulk of humanity was experiencing a brisk and perhaps undeniable progress, be it on health outcomes, mortality was declining, for example, overall poverty rates as well. But it also seemed to put forward a pretty sceptical argument about how we all remember that period. And I felt like it was challenging us to say, was that narrative of progress ever really real? Were they the right metrics by which we were measuring this thing that we amorphously call development? And I'm actually reminded last week I was at the War College speaking to a number of people who are not so familiar with development. We ended up in a 45-minute discussion around what development actually is or is not, and how are we conceiving of the way that Australia operates as a development actor in the world. Jo, what were your takeaways from the article?
Yeah, I think that's pretty similar to what I took away from it. I think this idea that there is a model of development, I think it's easy to discredit that notion or say, of course, there's no cookie cutter approach or formula to development. It's very context specific. We say that, but do we actually practice it? Those that work in development, do we all have in the back of our minds, shaped by our own history and learnings and studies and experiences, some concept of what development looks like? And do we bring that to the table in whatever we do? I think it's a really big, important question for everyone to be asking themselves, because it does shape so many of our assumptions. When people go to different countries to offer advice or provide resources or run projects, in the back of their minds, do they have some sort of model of what they think things should look like? And are they basing their advice and their resources and their projects on that?
So I see this in Canberra all the time. I'm going to stereotype here, but stick with me. I can speak to one group of the development sector. They might, for example, think that development comes from supporting those who suffer the greatest poverty. They're going to be focused on a development program that addresses vulnerability. That would be very different, for example, if I'm speaking to a development economist, James, who is very interested perhaps in the macroeconomic settings, labour, mobility, industrialisation. That's different again, say, to our broader foreign policy community, who might be thinking about development in terms of influence, engagement, elite structures of governance and reform. Are they the sort of those secret mental models you're saying that we all hold within us that really dictate then how we think Australia should act as a development player?
Yeah, definitely. It's partly the analysis of the problem, but it's also what do you think you're doing about that problem and how are you doing it? This article really challenges us to say, well, what are those models in the back of our head? How is it shaping the way that we are viewing the issues and how we're coming at them? Where it concludes is where I think development is in my mind, which is that it is about who are the actors that should be taking the lead in determining what those solutions are, what the real problems are and how to address them. I think it does take us to locally led development, to coalitions of developmental actors. They need to work strategically to address those issues and all the complex challenges, the polycrisis. As donors in the development system, what is our role in that? That's the key question that we've arrived at through decades of having these different development models that are shaping and influencing the system. We do need to be cognizant that it's not greenfields. We are all coming at this with our own biases and viewpoints and perspectives, and the more honest we are about that, the more that we can let them go and try to focus on the legitimacy of the actors that should be tackling these problems.
James, can you help make this real for a policymaker? I mean, this is sounding very big, very philosophical. The article is saying that we need a new framework for development, something that's ambitious and visionary on the one hand, but very realistically grounded on the other. And Joe's saying whose views on development really ought to matter most here. How would you brief somebody high up in the bureaucracy about what this article means and what it means for their work in Australian development?
The first thing is, we shouldn't be briefing anybody on just one paper, right? This is a deeply complex area, and this is one contribution to the subject, right? What are its deeper insights? I actually think its conclusions are stronger than its analysis. In fact, arguably, they don't lead from its analysis. For those who haven't read it, I don't think it's correct to suggest, as the paper does, that growth and poverty reduction is tailing off in the last 20 or 30 years. I think actually the opposite is probably true. And we've seen from the 90s a great convergence between the poorer and the wealthier countries that wasn't taking place when this paper was suggesting we were seeing great progress, which was from 1950 to 1980. But I do agree with Joe very much that the drivers of development outcomes are not the donors. They're the partner countries themselves and the populations of the partner countries themselves. And it's our ability to listen to them, to take off those biases and assumptions and negative stereotypes, to be able to understand how to adjust the tools that we might have available to support the tools that the countries that we're working in have got available to come up with outcomes that are sustainable and desired by the population. And that's far easier said than done. If I was bumping into a policymaker now, I'd be saying, how many papers have you read in the last year? Which ones have you read? And what have you learned from them? There is never going to be a silver bullet. The whole point of the poly crisis is that it's becoming more and more complicated. We need to read more about these. So it's not really what the paper says, but it is a major paper. And I think it's the sort of thing that we should be reading and discussing as a community.
I can see a task ahead for us before the next episode. Perhaps we need to put together a little bit of a reading pack for Canberra policymakers. We'll see if we can up the ante on things there. If we can turn now to our third topic for today, which is, of course, the new development policy. We are still being told that its release is imminent. Hopefully next time we're behind the mics, we've got something to look at and to dissect. What I do want to look at today is something that I've been quietly wondering about. I am wondering if, whether it be consciously or unconsciously, Australia is actually looking to reset the paradigm of how we think about development. Now, the evidence that I'm going to use to test this question with you is the terms of reference for the new development policy. Those of you that have been around the traps for a little while know that most development policies come up with a great couple of three-word slogans, or they all have pillars. They perhaps have thematic areas that they invest in. Think health, think education, think governance. What I found interesting about the terms of reference for this new development policy is that it set out four key principles. And I am wondering whether or not we are going to see these principles rewrite the future direction of development. I'm not Pollyanna enough to think that this is going to happen quickly, rapidly, drastically, but I do see it as an opportunity. I'll give you the four principles. The first one is that Australia will focus on building effective, accountable states. The second one is that we will support states enhance community resilience to external pressures and shocks. The third one is that we will look to connect partners with Australia as well as regional architecture. And the fourth one is that Australia will look to generate collective action on global challenges. Now, government can, of course, choose to make these the four central organising principles of the new development policy, or it might just, you know, pop them in four dot points up front and not worry about them thereafter in implementation. What does this mean? And do any of those four key principles signal something different to you about the future of Australian development?
So, having been a veteran of a few policies, I don't think that these statements are setting us up for a major shift. I do actually think there is a shift happening, but I'm not sure that any of these in and of themselves are sufficiently different to suggest a new approach to development. I think it's going back to what Joe was saying right at the beginning when we were talking about the Prime Minister's speech in Singapore. I think all of these statements, broadly speaking, are ambiguous. They can be applied to development and to strategic. So maybe that's more deliberate than it has been before. Maybe I'll grant you that.
So one interpretation is that this will possibly help Australia to start thinking about its role as a nation and how it engages in its region in terms that are beyond just an aid budget or an aid project, right? To take the Samantha Power USAID turn of phrase, is this something that enables us to think more about progress rather than just projects? But I hear you, James. I mean, these are just words on a page until we see whether or not they are thought of and cascaded through implementation. What's your take, Joe?
I love that, progress, not projects. I think that's exactly where I hope it will go. I agree with James, you can't read too much into those four pillars. I guess if you take them, add on a commitment to locally led development, think about it through the lens of country planning processes, which we talked about last episode, then I am hopeful that, as you say, Bridie, we are moving beyond a formulaic shopping list of sectors towards a much deeper consideration of what kind of change we are all trying to drive towards and how we are trying to drive towards them. So that's my optimistic take. I hope that is what we will see and what this new policy will be encouraging.
I think I'm asking the question because what I often see when it comes to how Australia makes the really big choices around how we spend our development dollar is sort of a reductive, let's do what we're doing kind of mentality. So if we have a project, let's just refund it or let's reallocate the buckets of money around the thematic focuses. And I'm just really unconvinced that's the best way to generate a development outcome compared to, I guess, what Joe's talking about, which is what would happen if we did sit down. And I guess what you're saying, James, if we sat down country by country and properly listened and understood what the sorts of development challenges are in that country, and then we took it for granted that we actually only have a very small amount of money to spend and that we needed to focus that money on the sorts of things that back and perhaps could be in some way, shape or form a little bit catalytic around development, then I would love that conversation not to be, hey, let's pour more money into health or education. I'd love that conversation to be much more around what is the value that Australia can add in this situation, and that might be around connecting labour markets, for example. That might be about actually cleaning up our domestic act around consumerism, around anti-money laundering, around climate or otherwise. And so I guess I see an opportunity in that terms of reference where somebody inside the department has actually attempted, for the first time I've seen in any policy coming out of the development space for decades, they've actually attempted to set down a couple of principles around how Australia does think about its development program that go beyond just a project spent in a sector. And on that front, I think that that really needs to be applauded. I think it's going to be very, very, very hard to restructure a development program around that. I think it's going to come down to how we do country planning, which of course we discussed last week. But I really, really worry about the absence of basic principles and that flag in the sand that says this is what a development program is or is not. I worry that in the absence of that, that strategic ambiguity leaves us in a situation where our aid program could be spent on anything or everything under the sun. And so I see this as a very mild but important potential step in rethinking and actually setting strategy around Australia's development program. And what we know is that development projects work and generate effectiveness when they have strategic clarity in them. So I feel like this is a slightly more sophisticated attempt there. But I'm with you, James. I don't know how it's going to play out, if it's going to end up being more words on the page or not. Of course, the counter-argument to what I'm saying is bleedingly obvious, and that this is not some kind of strategic rewrite or shift of the development program towards an innovative new way of doing development. In fact, what it could be is a stepping back from some of the international architecture around development, a stepping back from OECD traditional rules and approaches to development assistance, perhaps even a stepping back from the sustainable development goals as well. What do you make of that?
I said right at the beginning that I think there are some shifts in the way that the aid program and the aid narrative is going, and I think that is the shift. I think it is becoming less focused on poverty and sustainable development goals. And I think part of the set of principles that you just talked through is the way that the department is looking to bring this together. Obviously, we have to see when the policy is released, but at the moment, seeing it from where I can see it, I think there's a view that it's a more politically realistic and pragmatic approach to move the sustainable development goals slightly aside and to look at what's feasible within the politics of the moment. I think that's the area that will be interesting to analyse. I agree with you that there's a lot of investment and sophistication and thought going into this. I'm not seeking to disparage the policy at all, but I do think that we need to be careful on taking statements at face value. And I think the big test, as Joe has said several times now, is in how these broader principles are translated into country-relevant actions.
I think it's our job to raise everyone's expectations about this policy as much as possible before it comes out.
That's it. That's our reason for being. Well, on that note, that wraps up our third episode of the readout in this series. So, Joe, James, thank you so much for joining us again. And we'll see you back on the couch next time.
Thanks, Bridie. Thanks, James.
Thanks. The readout is recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples, the traditional custodians of the Canberra area. We
We pay our respects to the elders, past, present, and emerging. This series, we've got two regular guests appearing on the program, Jo Cho and James Gilling. Jo is Head of Program Quality and Gender at DT Asia Pacific, and James is Regional Vice President East Asia and Pacific at ABT Associates. Both are appearing on the readout in their personal capacity. The readout will be back in 2 weeks' time. Subscribe to the readout wherever you listen to your podcasts and sign up for the lab emails via our website. Content production by Julie Bolton. Music by Vijani Matile.